Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Giants ace Tim Lincecum has won the NL Cy Young Award, becoming the first repeat winner in the major league since Randy Johnson was voted the prize four straight times from 1999 to 2002. Lincecum led the NL with 261 strikeouts and tied for the league lead with four complete games and two shutouts. Only 10 points separated the top three in one of the closest ballots in the award's history. Cardinals ace Chris Carpenter was second, and teammate Adam Wainwright finished third. Number 12 Oklahoma State enters tonight's football game against visiting Colorado, clinging to the slimmest of chances in the chase for the Big 12 championship. The Cowboys need to win while also having third-ranked Texas lose its final two games. Carolina and Miami kick off Week 11 of the NFL season tonight in Charlotte. The Dolphins place Wildcat running back Ronnie Brown on season-ending injured reserve yesterday. Both teams, Carolina and Miami, are 4-5 on the season. The Bulls play the defending NBA champion Los Angeles Lakers tonight in Game 2 of their lengthy road trip. The Hawks are in Calgary for the first time since they eliminated the Flames from last season's playoffs. The Blackhawks begin a stretch of away games after sweeping four straight at home. And St. Louis will try to lose its scoring blues on home ice tonight against the Phoenix Coyotes. The Blues have struggled on the offensive end, scoring two or fewer goals in 12 of their 18 games. They've lost two straight. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of Busey Bank's main branch in downtown Champaign, on the web at ratioarchitects.com. Ratio Architects encourages you to join them in supporting WILL.
It's 2:42. Now a story about a young soldier who stayed behind to care for her baby son when her Army brigade left for war. She was arrested and is now being confined to the post, Hunter Army Airfield in Georgia. She's waiting to find out what the Army plans to do. Nancy Mullane of member station KALW reports.
21-year-old Alexis Hutchinson is a single parent of a 10-month-old boy and a cook in the U.S. Army. The specialist had orders to deploy to Afghanistan on November 5th. But instead of deploying, she stayed home off base that day because she didn't have anyone to care for her son.
It was hard because, I mean, there was nothing I can do. And I just sat there with my son and thought, I'm going to get in so much trouble because I'm missing my flight.
The Army reports there are 85,000 single-parent soldiers. All are required to maintain an approved family care plan. It identifies who will take care of their child during times of drills, annual trainings, and long deployments. Specialist Hutchinson says her mother in California initially agreed to care for her son long-term. But in October, that plan unraveled when her mother realized it would just be too much.
I went home on leave, and my mother, she told me that she couldn't take care of my child. So as soon as I got back off leave, I let them know this, so they took it to my commander, and he gave me a counseling statement saying you have 30 days to come up with a family care plan.
But just 5 days later, on November 4th, Hutchinson says her commander told her that her brigade's deployment date had been moved up, and she no longer had the full 30 days to arrange for her son's care.
They told me I needed to figure out something and have someone pick up my son within 24 hours.
The day after Hutchinson missed deployment, she showed up on post with her son, Kamani, in tow.
They told me that because I missed movement, I'm going to jail. And they're going to court-martial me and give me a bad conduct discharge. And then I started crying a lot, and I tried to explain, like, I just want an extension. I just need time to have someone take care of my child. And they basically told me, I don't care.
Hutchinson's civilian attorney, Ray Sue Sussman.
When my client, Specialist Hutchinson, voluntarily returned to base, she was arrested and placed in jail on the base by the military police.
A licensed military child care provider was called to take custody of Hutchinson's 10-month-old son.
It was hard to watch my son get in a car with a complete stranger. It was very hard.
Specialist Hutchinson contacted her mother, Angelique Hughes, who flew from Oakland, California the next day to pick up her grandson.
When I came to pick the baby up, he was just like traumatized. You know, I couldn't put him down. He's clinging all on me. He's crying. And, you know, and then I'm thinking to myself, okay, now what has happened to this baby?
Kevin Larson, media relations chief at Hunter Army Airfield, says the Army recognizes that family care plans do fall through, and Specialist Hutchinson's case is under investigation.
It is being looked at by the command, and they are exploring all options together with Specialist Hutchinson and her counsel to ensure that we do right by the situation and come to the proper conclusion.
As Specialist Hutchinson remains confined to the post, her son is being cared for temporarily by her mother in California. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Mullane.
It's deer season in Michigan, and hunters are trekking through the woods trying to bag dinner or something special for the holidays. But hunting has become a little complicated in some areas recently. Just because you catch something doesn't mean you should eat it. That's because a stretch of river in Michigan was polluted with dioxin decades ago. In the fourth part of our series on Dow Chemical and dioxin, Sean Ali found the state thinks old dioxin pollution from a Dow Chemical plant poses a health risk today.
It was kind of hard for me to understand why wild game like deer or turkey might be contaminated from river pollution. So I hit up Daniel O'Brien for some answers. O'Brien is a toxicologist with Michigan's Department of Natural Resources. He says the problem starts with dioxin in the river.
It's in the sediments in these contaminated parts of the Tittabawassee River. And after flood events in the spring, when, say, mud from the river gets deposited onto bushes or whatever, and the deer browse those, then they pick up soil that way.
Part of O'Brien's job is to spread the news about the contamination. He says when you buy a hunting license in Michigan, you get this brochure.
It's a booklet that has all of the regulations for hunting and trapping in it.
These wildlife consumption advisories are voluntary, but they kind of read like owner's manuals. They lay out where the dioxin-contaminated animals are, then they tell you what animals you can eat and what parts. For example, no one is supposed to eat deer liver from the areas. That's got the most dioxin in it. And of the cuts you can eat, the advisory says how much and how often. Plus, they tell you who should eat less or maybe none at all.
Where kids might be more sensitive, they might have a more stringent advisory than somebody like me, who's kind of your middle-aged man, and we might not be as susceptible to toxic effects.
The idea is to protect people from dioxin and the risk it poses for cancer and diseases of the immune, reproductive, and developmental systems. It's an important job, given how big hunting is in Michigan.
We have 750,000 hunters every year that go afield and harvest 500,000 white-tailed deer.
Michigan scientists take the issue seriously, but I'm kind of curious whether hunters do. So I visit the Saginaw Field and Stream Club. Inside, there's this paneled wall with faded pictures of club presidents. It stretches from the club's founding in 1916 all the way to this guy, current president Tom Heritor.
We're still here today.
Heritor says his club is smack dab in the contaminated area, and everyone knows about the advisories, but, well...
The game advisory, I have not heard one person that has any problem with the deer or any of the birds around the watershed.
This goes for him, too.
Nobody is sick from it. I don't know of anybody that has died of dioxin exposure. That's never been proven. It's nothing to take lightly, but then again, I think it might be a little bit on the overblown side, too.
The state of Michigan tried to survey hunters like Heritor. Officials wanted to know if hunters were feeding tainted game to young children. That survey never made the budget. Before I leave the hunting club, Heritor wants to clear something up. He's actually mad about dioxin. It's in the environment, and he wants it gone.
There's absolutely no reason for industry to be polluting our natural resources, whether it be air, soil, or water.
Even if it's not like a slam dunk for sure,
killing people
off sort of thing.
Number one, God didn't put it there, it don't belong there. I mean, that's the way it is.
Well, Heritor wants the environment protected from dioxin, but not necessarily himself. State scientists say if Heritor changes his mind and he wants to reduce his health risk, they'll keep printing those game advisories for him. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
Many businesses want to become more energy efficient and reduce waste to save money. And some want to go further to become more environmentally friendly, but they're not sure how to do it. Julie Grant reports about groups working to help businesses move toward sustainability.
This party is full of business owners, union leaders, MBA students, and lots of other folks interested in figuring out how to run successful companies that aren't bad for the environment. Holly Harlan has been hosting these kinds of gatherings for nearly a decade. She literally has made it her job to help companies take steps towards sustainability. Back in 2000, she started this group, Entrepreneurs for Sustainability, known as E4S. When she started out, mostly she worked with startup companies. These days, it's more established firms. She wants me to meet Christopher Moody.
So, well, Chris works for a larger company, and he's on their green council at KeyBank.
Sure.
And so they're getting started on their sustainability journey, and he was just sharing with me what their first steps were.
Yeah, our first steps are to begin to understand what it is that we're currently doing, where are we now, and then figuring out, you know, the next step is, well, how can we improve upon it? I think that's where it all begins.
Really, it's doing a baseline, understanding, you know, what you're doing now and that's already moving in this direction, celebrating those successes, and finding the next steps.
Big companies of all kinds are getting on board the sustainability train. When Harlan first started E4S, most of the companies she heard from were green companies. They were offering things like green cleaning, green lawn care, and solar panels.
Whereas the companies like GE and Walmart, certainly this wasn't on their radar in 2000. But around 2006, then we started hearing more about existing businesses that wanted to change.
Harlan says E4S wanted to find ways to assist those already established companies to
also
make changes.
Trying to mitigate some of the electricity costs.
E4S parties aren't just for networking. They have an informational component. This one is focused on solar panel installations for businesses. Harlan is trying to give business leaders more information about whether it's a good energy strategy for their factories, banks, and startup companies.
And when is it right to invest? Is the technology ready? Is the cost, you know, what is the support that I can get to implement these? And so to understand the opportunity in solar. So providing people with that opportunity to, I say, kick the tires and really figure out, is this worth something for my business to invest in?
After an initial information party like this, E4S will offer workshops and tours so business owners can take a look at how solar energy is being used by other companies to give them a real on-the-ground understanding. Then Harlan's group goes one step further and helps those that are interested connect with solar installers. In recent years, sustainable business groups like E4S have been forming in cities around the country. Jeff Krutschke is with the Interface Carpet Company, which has been working to be a green business for many years. He says the business community needs independent groups like Entrepreneurs for Sustainability.
And it's interesting. Everybody's reading it. You hear it. It's on every billboard. But people really want to know, what does sustainability mean? And there's really not a whole lot of places you can turn to. You can go online, go on websites. But it's everybody trying to promote their own product.
The sustainability groups want businesses to see that they can reduce their costs while at the same time doing things better for the environment and society. Before she started E4S, Holly Harlan worked in industrial engineering and economic development. But once she heard about companies designing their processes more efficiently, more sustainably, her own light turned on.
I suddenly saw opportunities everywhere, in every place that I visited, from museums, hotels, restaurants, manufacturing companies, places to save money and places to make money.
Now Harlan is trying to get more people to see things differently, to provide a better quality of life in the future with good economic decisions today that just happen to be good for the planet. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
Britain's most cherished chocolate maker, Cadbury, a few weeks ago rejected a hostile takeover bid by the U.S. food company Kraft. Now Hershey says it is considering a joint takeover bid for Cadbury, along with Italian chocolate maker Ferrero. Both offers may need to be considerably sweetened, however, to persuade the British. NPR's Rob Gifford reports.
The Brits may have sold off Rolls-Royce to the Germans, and Manchester United may now play soccer under American owners, but hey, hands off British chocolate. It's an article of faith here that, never mind the Swiss or the Belgians, British chocolate is the best in the world, and British children have been waking up on Christmas morning since the Norman invasion with a big bar of Cadbury's milk chocolate in their stocking. Well, since 1824 anyway, when Quaker John Cadbury founded the firm selling hot chocolate as an alternative to alcohol. Cadbury built a model village called Bourneville that set the standard for workers' housing of the day, and where the main factory was known as the Factory in the Garden. So it's perhaps not too surprising that John Cadbury's great-great-granddaughter, Felicity Loudon, expressed shock that such an iconic British firm might, as she put it, disappear into an American plastic cheese company.
I don't know that they would understand the history of Bourneville Village, the sort of great history of the philanthropy that went with it. I don't think they'd understand that it was the garden factory that was created and that every single house had a garden with a vegetable patch, with an orchard, and that my great-great-grandfather thought that nobody should live or work where a rose cannot grow.
The confirmation yesterday that US chocolate maker Hershey was looking at the possibility of making a bid for Cadbury has added a little spice to the chocolate. Not to be outdone, as the torchbearer of paternalistic mustachioed chocolate makers, founder Milton Hershey was also well known for caring for his workers and for establishing a long tradition of philanthropy. Analyst David Buick of BGC Partners in London says the likely need for layoffs, or redundancies as they're known here, might make a Hershey-Cadbury combination less likely.
If a business is a business, you have to take the emotion out of it. Both would have to implement huge cost-cutting exercises, which encompasses redundancies, which is inevitable. And that appears to be against the culture of both companies. Therefore, I don't understand the rationale.
Illinois-based food giant Kraft made an initial offer of about $17 billion for Cadbury's in September, which was rejected. Kraft then reiterated its offer at a similar price on November 9th, prompting Cadbury's to call the offer derisory. Still, analyst David Buick's money is on Kraft winning the battle.
Kraft really need this deal for the simple reason that their figures were very disappointing in the third quarter. And they believe that the acquisition of Cadbury's would deliver significantly increased shareholder value. Most people can understand the rationale behind. What has surprised us is that a more realistic bid has not already been tabled.
A new bid may be in the pipeline from Kraft. Hershey and Italian chocolate maker Ferrero said they may make a further announcement in due course. Rob Gifford, NPR News, London.
Earth and sky.
There's been a lot of research on the setting in which life on Earth may have begun. And there are various fashions, but one of these is that it might have started hot and deep.
You're listening to astrophysicist Paul Davies of Arizona State University. He studies the origins of life on our planet.
It may well have started 1 or 2 kilometers beneath the seabed near one of the volcanic vents that are so common, where the internal heat of the Earth comes up and meets the ocean and creates thermal pandemonium.
Tiny microbes